Welcome everyone to our first English episode of Mentes Sin Fronteras. And we are having some intermingled English speaking episodes to be more inclusive to our audience because there are plenty of Hispanics and Latinos that their primary language is not Spanish. So we still want to be inclusive. Today we have Diana Mesa, who is a registered dietitian, and we're going to be diving into what is diet culture? How does it impact us, especially in the Hispanic and Latino community? So, welcome, Diana.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Can you help us understand, your credentials and, the difference between, nutrition, nutritionist, registered dietitian, all of that?
Definitely. So, aside from also being a registered dietitian, I am a certified diabetes care and education specialist. So, that's an advanced credential that a lot of dietitians get to support their specialties to make them better rounded in all of the diabetes lingo, be it medication to devices, so that they can better support the populations that they're working with. Now, going back to the RD credential, that registered dietitian credential is unique in that it is quite rigorous to get. You have to have, now they have a master's degree requirement. So that's 4 years of undergraduate education, then another 2 years of a master's degree, and then you have to do about a year-long internship ranging anywhere from 900 to 1200 hours of supervised practice in all of the areas of dietetics. So it's not just clinical or counseling. We also have food service. We have community nutrition. And so there's lots of different areas in dietetics that we have to be experts in before we even go and sit for the test. Then we have the board exam. So the board exam is kind of the last, hurrah before we get all of our credentials. And once we do all of that, then we get our registered dietitian credential. Adding a layer of complication to that, we also may need to get a state license. So just because you have the RD credential doesn't mean it's legal to practice as an RD across the country. Each state has different rules and regulations. So some states require one. For example, here in Florida, a license is required to be a registered dietitian and to practice and give nutrition advice, which means that nutritionist is a term that is loosely used that doesn't have a lot of legal protections around it, right? So you could call yourself a nutritionist if you have a passion for food, or if you are a health coach, but it doesn't meet the criteria required to actually practice individualized nutrition care in the state of Florida. So you won't get reimbursed for that through insurance, and you also have to understand that nutrition is not just about food, right? Food impacts our health in many ways. So especially in diabetes, if we're making recommendations around foods that may help lower blood sugar, or eating practices that may help lower blood sugar, you want to go to a trusted individual for those recommendations. You want to make sure that they understand the interactions with the medications that you're taking, how your exercise is impacting your blood sugar, all of those little nuances that somebody without that science background and that biology and human sort of anatomy education might not have. So I know that's a lot, but
Yeah, but
it's a lot. It's a lot to
it's
get that
important to
credential.
distinguish, right? You've put in a lot of work, a lot of time into your education. And like you said, it's regulated, which is important because anybody can use that term loosely, nutritionist. Very similar to therapy, actually. Therapists, you can use that for many different specialties. But a licensed mental health counselor, for example, licensed clinical social worker, that's where it's accredited and yeah. So, how long have you been in practice for?
Let's see. I became a registered dietitian in 2018. So that is already 7 years. Yeah, 7 years now. Almost 7 years in August. And then before that, obviously, had my 2 years of nutrition education. At that point, I had already gotten a bunch of undergraduate education. So I just needed to do 2 years worth of the meat and potatoes because I already had all the sciences and stuff. So, but I was working in community nutrition as a nutrition educator since 2016. So it's been 9 years at least.
Very long time.
Yes, very long time. And it just flies by.
I can relate to that for like my internship and then finally getting licensed. And you're always learning too because science is always changing. So, with those continuing education and units is important too and required. But
Absolutely.
let's kind of like dive into diet culture. And so we share a lot of cases together, and it's been a pleasure to work with you because you're very patient, and kind and gentle, because it's a very, vulnerable thing to talk about. And for a lot of people, they can't escape diet culture. I would say nobody does, to be honest. So in your words, what is diet culture?
Ooh, that's a big one. And thank you. I love working together and helping our mutual clients feel better. So, diet culture is a system that we exist within, right? It involves a lot of different behaviors, but it definitely upholds a sort of morality around food. It pins foods and wellness as something that is individuals' sole responsibility. And, if you don't achieve wellness, if you don't achieve health, if you don't achieve thinness and those Western ideals of beauty, then diet culture deems you less worthy of love, of care, of all of the things. So it's, I would even call it a system of oppression. And we can see it impacting all of everybody, really. I mean, across gender, ethnicity, all of the things.
Definitely. And I know for me personally, it started at a very young age, starting to notice some of these narratives and how a lot of it really starts in the home. Kind of seeing how my mom would talk about herself and how my grandmother would talk about them, and like even TV, like commercials. And I think it's important too, and we talk about this in therapy, it's not about blaming somebody. Because there was a book, and one of the therapists I work with mentioned it. Every mother was a daughter at one point, right? And men are also susceptible to diet culture as well. Like dads were once, sons. And a lot of this is like generational belief systems. And, yes, it's a problem and it was inflicted on us. And it's also our job to be informed and to try to break this generational behavior. Just for a more sustainable and like pleasurable, meaningful life. For you, you're Hispanic and as am I. Where did you see that kind of play a role specifically, within our community?
Yeah, well, I was fortunate enough to have a mother who didn't have at least overt body image issues. And her concern more than anything was me eating enough. So there was a lot of messaging around eat more, eat more, eat more, and you haven't eaten anything at all. And even if I had eaten, 2 plates worth of food. Now, however, things have changed. And as she's gotten older, and as she's gotten on social media, and as she's just been Americanized, I was born in Cuba. We came to the United States when I was 4. So there's also that context of food insecurity and how important that was to be food secure. But now that food security is not an issue, the obsession with thinness has really kind of taken over for her. And I see this so much in the work that I do, and I'm sure you do too, where absolutely the way that I'm not a mother, but if I am ever a mother, the way that I would speak with my child, I would have to kind of be aware of the implications of that with all of the knowledge and experience that I have now as a professional. Because it really is impactful and we see it across the board. Maybe when I was a kid, it wasn't my mom, but it was definitely my tia, right? She's always been on the bigger bodied size and it's always been a topic of conversation. Ay, qué linda, you're so pretty, but if only you lost some weight. Tapa de la boca, que estás comiendo mucho. That's another one that is popular around the table. And it was only a matter of time before the comments started being focused on me and my body, right? So that is something that I think is just so prevalent in our communities. And the whys are very complex, but there's also this piece of aligning to the dominant culture and what the dominant culture sees as superior when it comes to beauty and health. So yeah, that's a little bit of how I see it coming up, just one way.
Yeah, I agree. And like you said, the comments first start, about themselves, and then at one point it starts to kind of target you. And again, it's not malicious. I really don't think it is. I mean, some people say things to be mean, but from my experience, like that was not the intention, right? If we think about it with the thin ideal, if what we're being told is the thinner you are, the smaller you are, the more beautiful you are. Also, with weight stigma, kids getting bullied at school for being in larger bodies or not being like the typical beauty standard of the United States. And parents don't want their kids to endure bullying. They don't want them to feel maybe the shame they felt. And so this is a giant, trauma response to have your children not experience what you did, right? And so I can see that. That empathetic approach, it's just not landing, right? And it's all just about education and insight, which I'm hoping that this episode provides is like a little snippet of truth, because there's so much inaccurate information on TikTok and Instagram. I know, like, my mom came from Cuba as well, and I started to go to like bar and bat mitzvahs, and they're like, oh, te tiene que poner una faja, porque no te quiere ver, your belly button or whatever. I'm like, una faja, like, what is that? And I wore one for the first time and it was so uncomfortable. And I had like digestive issues after for like a week. It was horrible, so constricting. And that was like the messages I was being told, like, this is what we do as women,
Absolutely. My goodness, fajas. There was a time when waist trainers were hot when I was in high school. And I would, without any need, I don't think anybody has a need to wear a faja, but I also see the validity of wanting to wear a faja in this society, right? But I remember just wearing that faja and somebody actually made a little bit of fun of me, like, oh, you're wearing a faja, don't be so ridiculous, you know? So there's also the mixed messaging of, well, you want me to look this way, but then I wear the faja and then I'm ridiculous. And it's like you can never please everybody.
Yeah, it's that disorganized attachment with diet culture, and it's just to show how it's not sustainable because it's always changing. Women's bodies typically trend every 10 years. If you look at the Roaring 20s versus the early 2000s, Kim Kardashian had a very big impact on beauty standard, more curvy, right? And so all of those things start to shift, and if we're always trying to fit the mold, we're never really ourselves. And you can really lose it.
Awesome.
What are some common like diet culture myths that you hear as a registered dietitian?
Ooh. Well, I think the biggest one is that my weight is equal to my health. And that one is just so such a big myth, right? Because our weight is only one factor in the whole picture that makes us up. And you can't tell somebody's health by a number on a scale, and especially not by a BMI. I don't know if you've got an episode on that one, but that one might need a whole episode. So I think that that's one of the biggest ones. Then there's also the fear around carbs and carbs causing weight gain and weight gain being a bad thing. So there's a few kind of conflated into one there.
And that kind of leads into the question I wanted to ask you about culture. And, we're both Cuban, and so arroz con frijoles, con maduros, bistec, like, I was that's what I ate growing up, and also puré. I don't know if you ever had puré growing up, where my abuela would get like sweet potatoes, chicken, and then blend it. Not my favorite because I've had it so much, but it changes then to, kale salads and diluting your salad dressing, and rice is bad for you, it's fattening, and you shouldn't eat these cultural rich foods that are such a big part of our community. So how do you navigate that with your clients?
With a lot of, compassion and with some perspective, right? Because when we think about white rice, it's not just our culture that holds it as a central piece of our food ways. We're talking about over 70% of the world eats white rice and uses it as a staple. So what, everybody's unhealthy because they eat white rice, so like when we start breaking down those beliefs and start kind of combating them with some real information and some real perspective, then it starts to create a little bit of curiosity, hopefully, and about where these beliefs stemmed from, right? Where did we hear them, and are they true, or are we hearing them from places that have been kind of tainted by those diet culture beliefs?
Have you seen that become a trend? Like, I think they call it like the gentrification of cultural foods.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And I mean, it started with avocados, right? You think about avocados, we were eating pan con aguacate since we were kids, and now avocado toast is like $15, $20 at a local cafe, and you wonder how did we go from hearing that avocados are too fattening in the 90s to now that they are a superfood and they have all these benefits and now they have to be part of every eating pattern, right? Whether it be keto or paleo or whatever kind of diet culture is spewing at the moment. So, and then there's also just the cauliflower rice. And don't get me wrong, there's nothing wrong with cauliflower. I love cauliflower, but we don't have to replace our rice with it to be better or to be healthier or any of the things, right?
And I like the term workability, and it comes from acceptance and commitment therapy, but we can apply it to food in that sense. Like you said, I like cauliflower. There's nothing necessarily wrong with it, right? But for someone with IBS, for example, like that's going to be uncomfortable sometimes to consume that much cauliflower. So it doesn't mean that the cauliflower is bad. It just may not work for some individuals. And it just depends on pre-existing conditions, and diet culture kind of lacks that nuance,
Right. It also lacks the consideration for preference. I think that it's very black and white. What is what and what is not? What is allowed? What is not? What is good? What is bad? It's very binary, and we know that that's just not how we exist in the world. There's always context. There's always opportunities to, get curious about something and see if something experiment with things. Maybe you experiment with white rice, and suddenly the IBS symptoms feel so much better. And so, it doesn't work for everybody. And I think that that's a message that diet culture communicates that sets our expectations. Well, I'm eating like the person next to me, so why don't I look like them? Thinking of all these what I eat in a day content pieces on social media, it just doesn't work like that. And we're set up to believe that it does.
I actually had some like Q&As that I gathered just from patients and family and friends because I knew we were going to do this episode. And one of the biggest things, because it's January, it's the first of the year, New Year's resolutions are all over the place. And the biggest one is I want to lose weight. I want to exercise more. And Christy Harrison, who's also a registered dietitian, talks about like the wellness trap, right? And now we're starting to hide it a little bit. A little cognitive dissonance going on of, oh, this is for my wellness to feel better. But in reality, the motivation and intent is from self-hatred, and not loving yourself for who you are. So how do you navigate that through dietetics?
So I use some psychology tools. So we explore values a lot too. So I think if we are, have at least some level of awareness about what we value in life, it becomes a little bit easier to navigate what is our own messaging and what is diet culture's messaging. I use a lot of different workbooks with my clients, and one of the ones that I use is the Intuitive Eating Workbook because it's got very actionable handouts that we can use. And one of them helps them decipher, is this diet culture or is this me? And in the eating disorder work, there's a little bit of maybe internal family systems parts work happening too, because we can help them separate those messages from the eating disorder part from their true self or their soul self. And so that's just a little bit clearly not, not the majority of the work that we do together. But typically with those small introductory tools, then in tandem with their therapist, we can really unpack a lot of the stuff that's happening for them. I think that's a really important part, just helping the client better understand who they are so that they can start to tune out what is them and what is diet culture.
Right. Value-based living is so important, and piecing how the appearance portion of it is really not ever really a priority for a lot of people when they start to do the values assessment. And they're like, wait a second, if this is not like my number one value, what is the reason that it's ruling my every day and my brain power? You know, thinking about my next meal or measuring my next meal and having anxiety around it. I know a big part of intuitive eating is, you know, debunking the morality of food, you know, good and bad food.
Well, I think good and bad is just going back to that binary thinking, because their foods, unless you are allergic to them or unless they're spoiled, and I know that that's like very cliche and everybody says that about good and bad foods, but that's the truth. There are no good and bad foods inherently, right? If you don't tolerate lactose, that doesn't mean lactose is bad. That doesn't mean dairy is bad. It just means that it's not workable for you, right? Just going back to that word that you brought up. So thinking about the context is important, helping people understand what their food rules are too, because a lot of people have they're so ingrained, they're so part of the way that we think and how we navigate the world that we don't even realize sometimes that they're with us while we're making these food decisions. And so just even helping identify, are there things that you're counting? Are there things that you're excluding because you believe that they will do XYZ to you and you don't want that to happen to you, right? So, getting curious about that and helping them explore is a good place to start.
Yeah, it really does challenge the binary thinking. I know when I talk to my friends and, you know, even my patients about good and bad and how it doesn't exist, right? It's like workability. You know, I'll get the response, well, oh, so are you saying McDonald's is good for you? Like, are you saying it's a good food? You know, like, and I always say, you know, in moderation, no, like McDonald's is not like poisoning you. I know there's a lot of fear mongering going on too with diet culture right now. Like, the fear around like seed oils and fried foods, and you know, it, that's kind of, you know, focusing more on like the clean eating versus like the junk food. And we don't realize how much that impacts our relationship with food, you know, and it happens all the time. I mean, I hear it in my lunchroom, I hear it, you know, at the gym, and it's just overwhelming sometimes, but you know. What, how can you like communicate that, you know, to anybody who's listening that's struggling with it? Because it makes sense if you've been told something for such a long time and now you're hearing, wait, is McDonald's good for me? Is it not? You know?
Right. Yeah. Well, I think, when we fall into the line of questioning, is it good for me or not? We're falling right back into the black and white thinking, right? And I think that we get really hyper fixated generally on certain ingredients and certain foods, but what we need to better understand is that the way that food impacts our health is in an eating pattern sort of way. It's not a just one meal did me over, gave me heart disease. That's just not how it works, right? And then to zoom it out even further, food is only one aspect of, I mean, hundreds that impact our health. And so one tool that I like to use, I like to pull up a social determinants of health pie chart. And so social determinants of health, for those listening who may have never heard of it, are the experiences, the systems, the environment in which we exist in, right? So our socioeconomic status, our neighborhood's walkability, our access to clean water and clean air, our access to health care. I mean, the list is endless, right? All of these things impact our health, and we put so much importance on food as the thing, because it's that one thing that we feel like we have a sense of control over, that we forget that the McDonald's isn't the thing that's impacting us in the way that we think, right? That's not what's going to give us diabetes, right? A lot of these conditions that we're living with, especially in the Latino community, are multifactorial, have so many different variables that can, increase risk just for being Latino. For example, we're at a higher risk of having diabetes, of having disordered eating and eating disorders. So we have to think about that. It's not all about food, even though diet culture tells us it is. Food and weight and exercise, right? Those are the three things that impact our health. What about stress? What about environment? What about sleep? All of the things.
Yeah, and how diet culture doesn't take that into consideration. I always use the example, of a single mom, and she's working two jobs and, she's exhausted. And sometimes the only access for dinner is a fast food restaurant. So are you now telling someone who is now experiencing burnout, oh, now you have to go buy all of this expensive food that is not really even accessible sometimes in order to make your children healthy, right? And that's not reality, and it doesn't take
Yeah.
into consideration income as well.
Right. Nor is it healthy to prioritize, the unaffordable, unattainable stuff that's causing you more stress and anxiety anyway. Like, we don't talk, I mean, I'm sure we do here in this space, but as a society, we don't give enough importance to the impact of our mental state on our health, on our physical health. We see them as two very separate things, but they're very intertwined. They are one in the same. And I think if whatever eating pattern, if whatever habit you're trying to adopt this new year with your resolution is causing you more stress, it's time to take a look at that and really weigh out if it's actually helpful or if it's not helpful.
And I think one of the hardest topics for breaking diet culture is the narrative of like you're a lot of people to lose weight, or they think, okay, eat less, eat less, eat less. And that impacts mental health with like brain fog and attention and focus and just overall wellness. And we always say, you actually probably need to eat more, right? Like you need to eat more. And they're like, wait, what? So how do you incorporate gentle nutrition, education, like fiber and like what do carbs do, fat, protein, all of that?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I never imagined when I was studying to be a dietitian that I would be telling people to eat more, because our education is also very steeped in anti-fatness too. So it's everywhere. But we sometimes don't start talking about nutrition right at the first session. I find that a lot of times we talk about things like self-compassion the first session, or finding small, tiny things to add to what they're already doing. Maybe they're not having breakfast. Maybe breakfast is a really big thing for them to start with. So can we add a little something to dinner, right? Can we add a piece of fruit? Can we add a vegetable? And everybody's going to be different, because obviously everybody is an individual with their own experiences. So that needs to be tailored to them. But once we once we kind of establish a little bit of the food rules, it gets a little easier to understand where we can start the education. A lot of people have misconceptions about carbs. So simply just explaining to them what carbs are supposed to do in our bodies and what to explain. And I see this, or sorry, what to expect. I see this a lot with people with diabetes, because with the diabetes, or not the diabetes influencers, but the wellness influencers who don't have diabetes with the glucose monitors, there's a lot of fear mongering happening there. And so people come to me and they're like, well, when I eat a carb, my blood sugar spikes up. And I'm like, okay, let's take a look at this, because carbs are supposed to increase our blood sugar. That is their job. And without blood sugar, our bodies are not running optimally. And so just getting a better understanding of what they know or what they think they know, and then talking about it, having just a conversation about, what's happening in our bodies, how does it actually work? And knowing that they're with a trusted science professional and not, some random person who has a supplement on their Instagram store or their TikTok store,
Yes. Yeah. I would say that's a big red flag if someone is like promoting, like before and after photos with like a droplet or, a super green drink, that's just probably best to not adhere to.
Yeah.